I was that subtle. My name is Solveig Cheseth, and tonight we're going to talk again about Namibia. I'm wondering how many people here were in the session the other day that we did. A significant number weren't, so let me maybe just do a very quick review of what we talked about the first session. The first session was intended really as an introduction to the country of Namibia and what had happened in Namibia from the time that the European colonialists began to arrive in Namibia in the early 1800s up until 1960, which is kind of, at least I view as kind of a watershed in the Namibian struggle for liberation. First of all, a review for those who were here and an introduction for those who weren't to the country of Namibia. It's a large country, it's twice the size of California, located on the southwest coast of Africa. You see South Africa down below, Botswana to the east, Angola to the north, and Zambia way out on the end of that point. Namibia has only two year-round rivers, and they form the north and south boundaries. The Orange River down here that separates it from South Africa, the Kunene and Kavango rivers in the north. And I explained the other day, some people ask why that little strip runs out called the Caprivi Strip. And the reason for that is that when the Europeans divided up Africa at a conference in Berlin in 1884, the Germans claimed both Namibia and what they called Tanganyika across on the other side of the continent, and they thought this might be a river passage through that would connect their two colonies. But right about here, you hit the Victoria Falls. And yes, I said it makes boating difficult, especially coming this way. But that's the reason for that little strip out there, the Caprivi Strip. Namibia is full of deserts. The Namib Desert that runs nearly this whole shoreline and runs back about 50 miles, so it's a formidable barrier, and indeed did keep Portuguese and other explorers from landing. They took, this is called the Skeleton Coast up in here because of the shipwrecks. It was really an inhospitable coastline, and so for almost 100 years after other places in Africa had been colonized, and Namibia was still protected by the Namib Desert and by the Kalahari Desert here on the east, and from the Okavango swamplands up there, it was really hard to get into Namibia. But underneath the desert sands, it's like gold and diamonds especially, copper mines, copper, oil, both offshore and within the country now, they are drilling for oil. The largest open pit uranium mine in the world is in Namibia. So though a lot of the country is desert, it has very, very rich resources. The Namibian people have lived, however, in poverty, in conditions of starvation, with an infant mortality rate in some places approaching one child in five, dying of malnutrition in a country that is a very wealthy country. Also, offshore is the richest fishing industry in Africa. But all these, the fish are ground up to make Purina cat food, if any of you have heard of it. That's one of the things I think of when I pour out cat food. And the beef cattle is exported, and so the Namibian people live lives have lived virtually as slaves in their own country. German missionaries came to Namibia in the early 1800s and settled in the central part of the country. They were from the Rhenish Mission Society in Germany. Unfortunately, they have left a legacy of real persecution for the Namibian people. It was the Rhenish Mission Society out at Otjimbingwe, which incidentally is now where the Lutheran Seminary is located, that first sent word that they wanted Prussian troops sent to Namibia. And that was about 1864. And along with the troops came a lot of German merchants. A man named Luderitz is probably the most infamous, who settled down in this part of the country. He suspected that there were diamonds there because he knew of the diamond finds in South Africa. And one of the early quotes from this man, Luderitz, is, "We aim to leave this country a gaping hole." So that his intent and purpose was real clear right from the beginning. And he is the one that made treaties with various Nama leaders in the south there and essentially cheated them out of their land, vast stretches of land. It was the early Germans that began the reservation system, which might sound familiar to us. At first forced the Namibian people from their land, robbed them of their cattle, and eliminated those who resisted. There was resistance now and again from these scattered groups of Namibians, the Nama in the south, the Herero, the largest population group in the center. The Ovambo people in the north were pretty isolated and not directly affected by German occupation. But these other groups were. And in 1904, the Nama chief, Maharero, sent a messenger to the head of the Nama folks in the south saying, "It is clear we must rid ourselves of the Germans." He wrote, "They keep shooting people for no reason at all, and this must be stopped." He invited the Namas to join him in an attempt to drive the Germans out. The Nama chief did not receive the letter, did not know of what the Herero plans were, and in January 1904, the Herero began military action against the Germans. But the sides were real unequal. And by August, the Herero were completely defeated militarily. And then the German General von Trotta issued an extermination order that all Hereros should be shot. And it's estimated there were 80,000 Hereros in 1904 and fewer than 8,000 to 10,000 just 3 years later. Then the Nama people got into the act, but too late, and for their trouble lost between 35 and 50% of their folks. Then in 1915, South Africa came in during the First World War, and although they presented themselves as the liberators of Namibia, they very, very soon instituted their own policies of oppression. Policies which included pass laws, homeland policies, certain areas where the black population was forced to live, certain arid, in most cases, areas. And in 1948, when the National Party came into power in South Africa, these measures were continued, were intensified, were codified under the apartheid system of South Africa. And that, I think, brings us about very quickly to where we were when we left off yesterday. In the 1950s, there were various attempts especially the workers, among the workers of Namibia, whom I had mentioned yesterday. Most of them were forced into a contract labor system where they would leave their homes, their families in these so-called reserves or homelands, and come south and work in the mines and the industries and the fishing industry and so forth. And among these workers, there began to be some organization of resistance. And there had been formed the Ovambo People's Organization in about 1958-1959. And then in 1959, in December, came something that kind of focused the anger and the sense of that justice was not being done among the black people of Namibia. Namibia, like South Africa, has insisted that black people live outside the city limits. And so there's, like South Africa, next to every white city, there is the black township or location. In Windhoek, it was called the Old Location, and it happened to be on kind of a nice hill and beautiful land and very close to the rest of Windhoek. So it looked like an ideal place for a white suburb. Mm-hmm. And so in 1959, the people were forcibly removed from what they call the Old Location. The people were sent to three places. They had no choice. The so-called colored or mixed race people were settled out 5 miles in a residence or an area called Comestal. The black population was forced into a place called Katatura, which they named and which really means this is not our home, or we will not stay here, depending on which translation. And then the older people, those unable to work, were simply loaded onto trucks and trucked out to reservations where many died en route and their families never saw them again. And that is one of the things that brought together the people of Namibia, united them in their opposition. The Ovambo People's Party became the Southwest Africa People's Organization, so that it would include not just the Ovambo in the north, but the whole country. And so it was organized in 1960 as a political party, remained a political party until 1966, when it began military activity as well. Another thing happened in 1960 that I think is very crucial, and that is the first black bishop, Bishop Leonard Awala, became the leader of the church in the north. And since the Herero massacre, the Ovambo people have been the largest population group. 60% of Namibia or so lives way up above this light spot on the map, just in a narrow strip. And so with the coming of black Namibian leadership to the church began to make some rumblings about the situation in the country. And I think that is an extremely important turning point in Namibian history. The Lutheran Church in the South, a few years later, elected a black leader. But it was the election of Bishop Awala in the North that was kind of a turning point. In 1966, the United Nations said that South Africa had betrayed its sacred trust, which it had agreed to back in First World War time, and had not provided for the well-being of the people of Namibia. It needed to withdraw immediately, but it ignored that decree. And it was in 1966 that SWAPO decided that it would have to fight for its own liberation, that you cannot expect liberation to be handed to you, and clearly it's not going to come through the UN. A number of the early SWAPO leaders left the country in 1966. Some of them had been imprisoned already, and this was in 1960 and 1966 were the two times of the biggest exodus in terms of SWAPO leadership. In 1971, the International Court of Justice was asked to rule on whether South Africa should maintain its control over Namibia. And they also ruled that South Africa was there illegally and must withdraw immediately. Now, South Africa rejected that decision, and in a move that, you know, demonstrates for me sort of the arrogance of colonial power, they were so sure that the black Namibians wouldn't do anything but agree with them. So they said, well, we disagree with the World Court, and I'm sure our black Namibians, our Namibians, will also. So they contacted Bishop Awala and wanted him to announce that, yes, the black Namibians did want South Africa to stay there and so forth. And Bishop Awala said, we need to discuss this in our councils. And they discussed it and formulated, first of all, a total rejection of South Africa's presence. But they wrote an open letter to the South African Prime Minister, quoting the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and indicating strenuous objections to South Africa's occupation, to the separate development, to the homelands, to the lack of voting rights, to the whole system. And this was published in the press, and it was also sent to every Lutheran congregation in Namibia to be read on June 30th, 1971. The Anglicans endorsed it 2 days later, and the Roman Catholics a few weeks after that. But I am told by Namibian people that the results, it was just an electrifying thing for the whole country. Namibia is 90% Christian, and everybody is in church on Sunday morning. It's unbelievable. Everybody's not only in church, they are in church for several hours on Sunday morning. But to have their religious leaders say out loud that what South Africa is doing is contrary to the gospel, and that as Christians we're called upon to pray for those in power that they may change this system. And it was just an unbelievable mobilization of the energy of the ordinary Namibian people. And it was that energy and determination that has continued up until today. And it was also, I believe, growing out of that unity of the open letter that led to the formation of the Council of Churches in Namibia, the only Council of Churches that has had Roman Catholic participation right from the start. It was clearly representing what 99% of the Namibian, or, you know, vast majorities, 95% of the Namibian people. And the Council of Churches in Namibia came to be the leading voice of the Namibian people in terms of protests to the government, in terms of speaking to the world, to the United Nations, to international world bodies on behalf of the suffering people of Namibia. In 1973, the United Nations recognized SWAPO, this Southwest Africa People's Organization, as the sole authentic representative of the Namibian people and gave it observer status at the United Nations. This is the only time, or at least the first time, I think the only time, perhaps, the first time at least, that a so-called guerrilla movement has had that recognition by the United Nations. In this country, SWAPO has had a very bad press. One of South Africa's ploys always, both internally in South Africa and in Namibia, was to picture anyone who opposed apartheid as a communist. In fact, the laws that were used to arrest people for protesting against the system and the laws under which many, many Christian pastors have been arrested were called the Suppression of Communism Act. So they were equating opposition to apartheid with communism. SWAPO certainly has had, during its years of struggle, a number of different political philosophies within the organization. And I'm sure they ranged Marxist, communist, socialist, whatever, all along the spectrum. But it has simply been a propaganda ploy by South Africa to continually brand them as communist, terrorist, guerrilla. The church leaders were asked, you know, who is SWAPO? And it was Bishop Dumeni, who is now the leader of the church in the north, and thus the leader of the largest Lutheran group in the country. Bishop Dumeni said, "These SWAPO is our children, our brothers and sisters, and while we believe in nonviolence, we do not condemn those who feel it is necessary to take up arms." SWAPO is one of the few guerrilla groups that held confirmation classes, marriage things, and all these church records were sent back to Namibia to the home churches of the SWAPO refugees and the SWAPO soldiers. So it's okay. Interrupt me at any time with questions. We just have a lot of territory to cover, and I realize I'm kind of throwing it at you because we have to come out to independence yet tonight.
Can you just comment on why the bad press in the U.S.?
Well, I think that South Africa knows that people in this country, at least up until the last year or so, react almost immediately to the branding, to the word communism. I mean, it's almost a knee-jerk reaction. And one of the things that was interesting to me is that branding of SWAPO as communist was not emphasized in Europe, where socialism and communism is not quite the red herring that it is here. South Africa has spent millions and millions of dollars on propaganda in this country, just every year. We used to, in the early days when I was young and energetic and even more fanatic, we used to follow, South African agents are required to register at where in Washington? With State Department or something? And here we would get, you could get the names, the amount paid, and what kind of propaganda they intended to do. And by following some of these names, you would see in the Dubuque, Iowa newspaper, letters to the editors from these folks. I mean, a tremendous propaganda system where they had a computer that would, anytime the word Namibia or whatever would pop up in a newspaper, they would get it on their computer and they could fire off a letter back. It was an amazing. And they would sign the letters sometimes. Once I remember, and Jim will appreciate this, in the Dubuque, Iowa newspaper, a letter supposedly signed by Peter Kalangula, a Namibian leader who cooperated with South Africa, one of the guys in the north at that time. Peter Kalangula was not reading the Telegraph Herald, I guarantee it. But and Dirk Mudge also wrote to some little town newspaper in Illinois. It was amazing. Okay. In 1977, the UN agreed on UN Resolution 385, which called for a South African withdrawal, and then the UN would have free elections. And early in 1978, SWAPO leaders were coming to New York to agree with this UN resolution to sign their names on the dotted line. And on May 4th, while they were en route to New York, South African soldiers attacked the Kasinga refugee camp way up in Angola. And it's come to be called the Kasinga Massacre. Probably 800 people, most of them women and children who had fled Namibia, were massacred that day. And you've probably seen pictures of a huge mass grave and so forth. The SWAPO representatives broke off the talks. They said, "We will go home to bury our dead." It had been an incredibly kind thing on the part of South Africa to once more delay Namibian independence. But the SWAPO folks came back later in the year and agreed to a watered-down resolution, UN Resolution 435, which the United States helped to draft, and which was really a compromise to South Africa. It allowed not that South Africa would withdraw and then there'd be elections that the UN would run, but that South Africa would run Namibia's elections. And SWAPO was so sure of its support and that it said, yes, we can still win, even with South Africa running the election. In 1980, we began to think, I mean, there were negotiations all the time. And the Namibians' hopes would be raised and then dashed, and raised and dashed. Well, finally, by winter of 1980, we really thought all of the hurdles had been crossed, and now finally, there would be agreement. But President Reagan had just been elected, and when the talks convened in Geneva January, February 1981, suddenly there was a new precondition, and that was that all the Cuban troops that were up in Angola had to be removed from Angola before we could discuss Namibian independence. It was a precondition. At first, our State Department denied that we had anything to do with it, but later they admitted, yes, that was something we had interjected into the talks. Namibians were furious because they felt they are being held hostage to U.S. foreign policy agenda. The U.S. wanted Cuban troops out of Angola. The Namibians said that should have nothing to do with us. But that was the big hurdle that we simply could not get over. That was in 1981. In 1985, a second very damaging blow from the United States was that we began to give large amounts of aid to a rebel party in Angola, UNITA. And I remember Bishop Dumini came to Gustavus Adolphus College in 1987. And I wish you knew Dumini. He is the quietest, just real silent, just real sweet. And he stood there in 87 and said, first of all, he condemned the linkage. You know, he said, as part of constructive engagement, the fact that they did not have to implement any peace plan in Namibia till the Cubans had gone home was simply unfair. And then regarding our aid to UNITA, he said, UNITA and South Africa fight side by side, killing Angolans and Namibians. It's clear that to the Namibian people that the U.S. is supporting South Africa's foreign policy. And then he said he had stopped at the State Department on his way to Gustavus. And he had been told by a State Department officer that the U.S. is too far away to take an active part in Namibia's struggle for independence. And he said, if it's too far away to send aid to help us, why is it not too far away to send arms and Stinger missiles to those who are killing us? Just a very, very strong statement regarding that. Well, given, and then the policy of constructive engagement kind of ground on and on, where to change. But why did change come? Why is Jim sitting there with a free Namibia, an independence t-shirt there? This change came very, very quickly, and it came over a period really of 4 to 8 months, maybe, in 87, late 87, early 88. It came for several reasons. First of all, the South African economy has been suffering very badly all through the 80s. The value of the rand has fallen drastically. I remember when it was $1.40, and now I've seen it at 39 cents. I mean, it's a massive cost. There's been a real impact on the South African economy, and certainly some of that from sanctions and the arms embargo. But it was costing South Africa more than $1 million a day to keep going in Namibia, and they simply couldn't afford it. That's one. Secondly, in the fall of 87, South Africa had launched an attack at Quito Carnaval, a town up in Angola, and it intended to wipe out SWAPO, and it intended to wipe out the Angolan troops in the area, and they gave a lot of publicity for some reason to the fact that they were going to sweep up there and get the job done. And then it never seemed to happen. October went by, November went by, December went by, and that was we left for Zimbabwe in January, and shortly after we'd gotten to Zimbabwe, before we got there, we were stopped in Namibia. We're up along the border, staying with Bishop Dumeni, and one morning he met us at 6:30 and said, "Don't go anywhere yet. There were troops moving all night." He said, "I don't know what it is, what's going on, but there's massive troop movements." Well, that was more South African troops going up to Quito Carnaval, and what happened was South Africa, partly because of the arms embargo, did not have superiority in the skies. And for the first time, the Angolan Air Force was defeating them. And it was a very sobering thing. But even more sobering was the mood at home in South Africa was changing. You know, before it's a patriotic thing, you're a young white South African, you march off to the border. And they didn't mean the border here, which is South African border. They meant the Angolan border, to fight for your country. Well, there started to be real draft resistance and parents groups that said, "No more boys to the border. We cannot afford any more South African deaths. Why should our sons be dying up in Angola?" And then, about February, we began in Harare to hear rumors that there were white South African soldiers trapped in Angola. And that's what had been moiling and toiling there. Some group had gone way ahead and the Angolan army, the Cubans, and Swampo had gotten between them and the border. And so here were, while South Africa had all these parents at home saying, our children, we don't want any more to die, they had a whole bunch of them stuck, trapped up in Angola. An interesting thing, in South Africa, they were not required to report the deaths of enlisted soldiers, certainly not blacks, but they had to report the deaths of draftees. And it would have been awful if they'd lost that whole bunch up there. That made them much more willing, much more open to negotiate. And finally, a factor that I don't see mentioned too much, but Bishop Dumeni said the school boycott, which hit early that spring. In Namibia, the Namibian high school kids in the north protested against the presence of South African troops in their schools. They go to boarding schools because there aren't nearby schools, and South Africa had its bases right at those boarding schools. And kids were killed, women, girl students were raped. It was a situation that finally the students said, no more, and went out on strike. And there were thousands and thousands and thousands of Namibian students out on strike. And I remember Bishop Dumeni saying, this strike by the students has united the country like nothing else has. The parents cannot say, our children are wrong. The children are showing this courage. We have to follow them. So within Namibia, there was this strong unity. So it was a combination of forces that really turned the whole thing around very, very quickly once it got started. So there were talks between Cuba, Angola, South Africa, and the United States. And on the 22nd of December, 1988, in New York, they signed the, what's called the Peace Accords, outlining the, agreeing to an end of South Africa's occupation and outlining the steps. Beginning April 1st, South Africa was to start withdrawing its troops. Cuba was to start withdrawing its troops. Everything was just kind of laid out. And
why were the Cubans willing to leave?
Why were the Cubans willing to leave? I would say for one reason was probably that Russia and Cuba, well, Russia certainly was less willing to pour its money into wars in Southern Africa. I mean, the whole East-West thing was even then starting to crumble. That would be one reason. I suppose Cuba had been there since 75. Probably the drain on them was enough that and then Angola was real tired of the war and probably ready to I mean, the effect, it's been absolute devastation for Angola. So I don't know anyone else got ideas about it, but those are some of the factors, at least.
I think the Russian one is a big...
They just
decided they're not going to fight wars in
Southern Africa.
So that's also been a part of the Southern and South Africa equation. They just, and Cuba had the people but not the money.
Right. I think as we're running short of time, let me switch. On the 1st of April, when this was to all start falling into place, there was a terrible setback. And Swapo troops came across into Namibia, where they were met virtually in an ambush almost the length of the border. It's something that I don't understand why Swapo came down. The Swapo soldiers left no, signs in the sand pointing to where they were. And they said they expected that the United Nations would be there to receive them. that they would turn in their weapons. Well, the UN was not nearly in place. They had something like 40 soldiers in the north at that time. And what was in place, supposedly South African forces were to be confined to base on April 1st, but they were all roaming the border. So they knew, obviously, that SWAPO was coming over. And it was the heaviest fighting in the whole war took place. Instead of the peace, the celebration on April 1st, it was devastation. But eventually the peace plan got back on track, which called, first of all, for the repatriation, the return home of the exiles. And the United Nations asked the Council of Churches in Namibia to set up the apparatus, basically. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees worked with what came to be called the three R's, repatriation, resettlement, rehabilitation, which was staffed kind of from the Council of Churches in Namibia. And within, 6 weeks or so, they repatriated 43,000 Namibians. The UN just says they have never had an operation run that smoothly. Church schools and church institutions were mobilized, temporary tent cities were built, and the refugees started streaming home. Many who had been in exile for 25 years. It was just a tremendous homecoming.
Did that group have to also make legal judgments as to whether these people returning own certain land or anything like that? Did it have anything to do with their permanent status?
It was set up, there were various stages. First was the repatriation. And they basically had registered in the camps where they were, had registered with the UN, and were flown in. Then they went to temporary receiving camps where they were to stay for a week or so. And they attempted to resettle them with family if they could find it or whatever. I have the land problem, the emphasis on land ownership is so much less there that I have not heard any discussion of returnees demanding land, right? Often they came and found where they had lived had been destroyed, and they set about rebuilding. But anyway, it was a huge job and apparently very, very well done. Then the next task is voter registration. And of course, you have to remember through all of this that South Africa was in charge of the election. They could write the rules, they could register the voters, write the rules for the election, print the ballots, count the ballots. So to many of us, it seemed like a futile effort. I mean, it made no sense. But there were lots of problems. One of the things that was interesting to me was there began to appear in South African newspapers what was called Project Namibia, an effort to get as many South Africans to come to Namibia and register to vote as possible. And so you could get free flights and bus trips to Namibia. They didn't call it Namibia, they called it Southwest, to register to vote. If you had a grandparent who had lived in Namibia, and you were a white South African, you are eligible to vote. And so or if you'd been there for 4 years, lots of soldiers had, or if you had paid taxes there, lots of business people had. So it was, that was one of the little crazinesses of the registration. And then another problem, especially in the north, was people would walk and walk and walk and get to a place to register, and the registrars, again South African controlled, would say, no, today we're only registering students, or today we're only registering those whose names begin with M, and these people would walk home again and try. But in spite of this, 67,000 people registered. And then we kept waiting for the election laws and the ballots. How is this going to work? And at first, South Africa insisted that the ballots would be put into envelopes and the person's name be on the envelope. It didn't strike any of us as secret ballots. And then all the ballots were to be flown to Windhoek, not looked at, opened there, and in a month, they would announce who'd won. I mean, it was just absurd. Finally, the UN there really insisted. And so 3 weeks before the election, finally, Namibians had the election laws and the ballot. And that, you know, for many, this is their first time they voted in their lives. Many of the folks, 60%, are illiterate. How do you quickly educate the voters? And we have a couple Namibian student friends in Denver who flew home and worked night and day. And to hear them tell it, you know, about how the old grandmothers would sit there and the little kids, SWAPO distributed millions of sample ballots. And one of the things that South Africa had done was to make the ballots terribly complicated. There were, what, 11 parties on there? Three of them had symbols that SWAPO used to use. You know, so for an illiterate person who can't read, he sees, you know, a torch. Well, that's always been SWAPO. SWAPO's torch is on everything. But it was for a different political party. So it was a deliberate attempt to confuse voters. And so these guys in Denver said they would tell the people, vote for the whole body. You know, SWAPO, one of its symbols is the raised fist. Well, in the election, a different party had the raised fist. SWAPO had sort of from here up with an arm up. That was their symbol. So it was very confusing. And then if you marked your ballot too big or too small, or if you did it with an X, it was okay. If you did it with a check, it wasn't. And the way these guys said, they used to tell, you know, the older people, an X in Namibia stands for a goat and a check for a cow. Well, people would tend to do a check because that's more valuable, right? That's a cow. And they would say, no, it has to be the goat. You make a goat and you make it at the ankle. The second, not the foot, the ankle. Second, because SWAPO was next to the bottom on the ballot. I mean, just amazing. How do you teach people who have never voted, who cannot read, and you have 3.5 weeks to do it in? It's just amazing. And then how do you get them to turn out? Election was November 7th to 11th. So there were these 5 days of voting. And people walked for hours and hours. There were long, long lines. Lines would be a mile long. People would wait for hours and hours and hours in the sun. Mm-hmm. And I have in my slideshow pictures of crowds waiting. And in one voting station, it was so crowded to get in that people who had voted had to go out through the window in the back. It's just incredible. Namibians were determined. You know, they told about old women just barely able to walk, just trudging through the sand. They were going to vote for their independence for their children. And what was it, 97% of Namibians, eligible Namibians, voted. It was unbelievable. SWAPO won 41 out of the 72 seats. I should mention, just to finish that South Africa thing, they set up voting booths at the airport so South Africans could fly in, vote, and catch the next flight back. Well, then the Namibians noticed this, and so they, a lot of them, went to vote at the airport because you could vote. And so the frustration on the part of the South Africans, they were missing their flights. The second day, they set up two lines. Because who's running this election again? South Africa. Two lines, and instructed black Namibians they had to wait and let the whites go first. Well, by the third day, the UN had gotten that stopped. But just the audacity was amazing. We have a picture probably, well, maybe not in this newsletter, but of the whites sitting there at the airport, you know, voting. Okay, I keep hurrying. When do we have to be through here in 10 minutes, don't we, sir? Let's see. Okay, so Swampo won 41 out of the 72 seats. This was enough for a majority. It was not enough so that Swampo could put its own constitution in place. But that probably was a good thing, because then they had to negotiate. They had to do some talking with the other parties. Yes?
Wasn't it expected to be higher? And was that because of the confusion with the ballots, the difficulty, or not, or was that?
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, they know that at least 10,000 South Africans voted. Well, that would be a big hunk right there. And now a surprisingly small number of ballots. I think something like 6,000, maybe, were ruined, which. You know, when you're dealing with people who have never voted and can't read, it was a small. So, the Swampo kids say, oh, we were robbed, you know, and we'll tell about instances where there were some ballot boxes that disappeared and, you know, some harassment of voters, but I don't think we'll ever know.
How many ballots were counted? How many people voted?
How many people voted? Well, I didn't figure the math. How many did I say had registered?
67,000.
67,000. Okay. Yeah, so it was almost that. 97% of those voted. But, you know, 10,000 South African votes, that's a big block when you're dealing just with 67,000. Okay, our beloved Bishop Zivanya Kameta, who was here at Holden some years ago, was one of the people elected to the Constituting Assembly, and he was the one that opened the first meeting with prayer. And the Namibians proceeded very, very quickly to agree on a constitution that is described as one of the most democratic, certainly in Africa. It provides for abolition of death penalty. Its racism is not allowed. There may not be discrimination on the basis of race or religion. There should be freedom of press. Written into the Constitution is a clause on women's equality. So it's one of the most progressive constitutions around. And that then set the date, or they set the date then for independence. Stand up, Jim. 21st of March, 1990. They became independent. It was amazing. I have this marvelous older friend, Elizabeth Landis, who has been working. She's a lawyer, a constitutional lawyer. She has been with the United Nations working on Namibian issues, 40 years maybe. And she said she sat there at the independence just waiting for something to go wrong at the celebration, and it didn't. And she said, now March 21st is Sharpeville Massacre in South Africa. And Betsy wrote, from this day forth, the contrasting events of the Sharpeville Massacre on March 21st, 1960, and Namibia's independence on March 21st, 1990, will become indelible images of apartheid's savage cruelty and its inevitable defeat. And I wanted to end there. The next session we'll look at what's ahead for Namibia, and then I have a Jim Dandy slideshow on Saturday night I have 180 slides.
That's great.
Which Jim says we'll never get through it. Well, I mean, you do yours so well, but I'm less selective, and I figure if one picture of the celebration is good, probably six are better. So please come back to that.